Now, for this morning's talk, we have one of my favorite subjects, the jhanas. If anyone looks at these suttas, they will find the Eightfold Path which leads to Nirvana culminates in this last factor, the eighth factor. Sometimes they call it right concentration. Sama Samadhi. What that means is the four jhanas. In the time of the Buddha, when they talked about meditation, that's what they meant. Jhana. The word for meditation was jhana. This was right meditation, jhana. Important part of the Eightfold Path. Sometimes neglected. But without that jhana, it's so hard. Impossible, I say. Well, not just me. The suttas say impossible to get fully enlightened. Nati jhanang apanyasa panya nati ajayato. Yamhi jhanang chapanya cha sawe nibbana samtike. One of my favorite sayings. There is no jhana without wisdom. There is no wisdom without jhana. But the one who has jhana and wisdom is in the presence of Nibbana. They're that close. So, first of all, you can't get jhana unless you've got some wisdom. But then, you don't have wisdom unless you've got jhana. Sounds like a catch-22, but like most people, like most things, the wisdom, the meditation, the understanding, the letting go, the insights, they come together, and they build up and build up and build up until jhana happens. And jhana is one of the most important aspects of the path, because that gives you some extraordinary experiences. This gives you the uncommon data. I like the word data because I used to be a scientist, and you realize to understand the nature of things, you have to look to see what's out there, to see the data, to see the evidence, first of all. And then once you have that evidence, then you can make your conclusions. So one of the important things about jhana experience is it gives you extraordinary data about the nature of this mind, this universe, data which you can't find any other place. And that's the data which will eventually be used to understand what Nibbana is all about. Especially it's the data of non-self, anatta. So many people get stuck on the Buddha's teaching of anatta, of non-self. And this is where you really see it so clear and so bright you can't miss it mostly. But let's go back what jhana actually is. In this path of meditation which I've been teaching and encouraging during this retreat, you can see that I've emphasized happiness. The whole path, the Eightfold Path, is the path of ever-increasing happiness. If you'd like to check this out, one of the beautiful suttas is the Samanyapara Sutta, the second of the Digha Nikaya. There is where the Buddha first describes what he calls the gradual path to awakening. That gradual path is an extension of the Eightfold Path. It is filling it out, fleshing out the details, giving the usual way a person becomes enlightened. Starting out with faith in the Buddha's teachings. Usually say a young man, a young woman, hears the Buddha's teachings, gets faith. And then abandoning small circle of friends or great circle of friends, a large fortune or small fortune, leaves the world to join the Sangha. Whether you leave the world or not, the next thing is that one starts to keep a morality, to keep one's precepts, to live simply, to eschew the world so that one can develop the mind. One of the most beautiful of the similes which the Buddha gave, which shows just how important it is to actually to leave that world by keeping precepts, is a simile of the fire stick. A similar fire stick goes like this. In those days when there wasn't matches or cigarette lighters, if you wanted to make a fire, you had to rub two sticks together. And the Buddha said that if a person gets one of those sticks out of the river and tries to make fire with a wet, sappy stick, they're going to get much weariness and trouble. They're going to get frustrated. They cannot make fire with a wet and sappy stick. So the person throws away the wet and sappy stick, and they pick up another stick which is lying close to the river but on dry land. That is sappy, but it's not wet. In other words, it's moist inside but dry on the outside. That too they can't use to get fire. It is too damp, so they throw that away. And then they go much further from the river, a long way from the river. There they find a stick which is dry on the outside and dry on the inside. And that you can get a fire with. In that simile, the wet, sappy stick, the one they pick out the river, is the human being, or the monk, or the nun, who is still indulging in the world, who's right in there, enjoying the pleasures of the senses. They are wet, they are sappy, and if you try to meditate with a mind like that, indulging, not keeping precepts, you'll find it's almost impossible to get into those deep states of meditation. Your mind will just not take the fire. Even someone who's just recently been taken out of the water of sensuality, someone who has just left the world to come on a retreat, sometimes then you're not dried out enough. So it takes a while to dry. For those people who've left the world, who are dry, who don't get too concerned with sensory pleasures, who've kept their precepts for a long time, they're not just dry on the outside, they're dry on the inside. That's the stick they find a long way from the river. That easily bursts into flame. It's a very good simile, because the word for burning, bursting into flame in Pali, is the same word as jhana. So that's what that simile means. So to get into jhanas, you need some preparation first of all. The precepts are important, but it's not just the precepts, it's one's simplicity of lifestyle. It's the goodness of one's heart. It's the selflessness of one's practice. That's important, because that dries one's out, that lets you be a little bit detached from the pleasures and attachments of the world. So it takes a while to get into these jhana states. You've got to dry out first. And you've already experienced that when you've been trying in these last few days to meditate, to let go of those attachments, to let go of this world of the five senses, which is basically that river. Because this is what jhana is all about, letting go of some of the most refined attachments, which most people just do not know are even there. This part of meditation, whether you use the breath or use metta, these are perhaps the two main ways of getting into jhanas. You can use these lights called kusinas, but I'm not going to talk about that today. The whole point of, say, the breath, is you get to the point where all you can see is the breath going in, the breath going out, and the rest of the five sensory world disappears. Many of you have already experienced that. You're sitting here, and you may just as well be in some remote monastery in the Himalayas, in some deep jungle, because you're no longer aware of the people around you. You're no longer aware of your family and your friends, of your money. You have left a small or large circle of friends. You have left a huge or small amount of money when you sit down here and you completely forget about it, and you go inside your body and mind. You do leave aside the worries and concerns about the past and the future. You're letting go of many things. But most of you find it so difficult when you're watching that breath to let go completely of things like sounds and thoughts. Those thoughts come and go into your mind. They find a crack and enter in. Those sounds of people coming and going, the sounds of the traffic or whatever, they'll find a way of sneaking in and taking your attention away from the breath. Which is why in the Anapanasati Sutta, which is why in the way I'm teaching this meditation, the ingredients of inner happiness becomes crucial. When you're watching that in and out breath and happiness starts to come, then you will find that you are able to actually to keep out those sounds. You're able to keep out even feelings in the rest of your body and thoughts as well. You're so happy watching the breath, you simply can't hear anything. You can't feel the body. You don't know anything else. Happiness is the glue which sticks mindfulness to its object. I think I've said already, I think it might have been in the interviews, about sometimes your husband might be watching the soccer on telly and it's time for his dinner. You say, "Darling, dinner's ready," and he can't even hear you. It's an example from the world about when we're really absorbed into something with happiness, we can't even hear what's going on around. Sometimes those two disciples of mine who were watching the television, they were so involved in what was going on they couldn't hear the burglar come into their house behind them. That's a true story. The burglar went into the room where they were watching the television and stole things from right behind the sofa on which they were sitting. They couldn't hear a thing because they were absorbed into the movie happening on the screen of their TV. That happens so often in life. Why can't we have it happen in our meditation? Why can't we get so deep into our breath, having so much fun and enjoyment watching it, that we can't hear people coming and going in this room? Why is it we can't get so deep into our meditation? We can't hear the bell at 11 o'clock when it's time for dinner. We don't even know what time it is. We forget completely about our lunch. Wouldn't that be nice? You can always eat another time. But it's very hard to get into those deep states of meditation. So what is actually happening here when the beautiful breath, this is my way of describing, just in other words, what the Buddha meant when piti sukha, happiness and joy, comes up. When you start getting that happiness, then you have the path into samadhi. Samadhi is a stillness, so still that you let go of so much of the world. That happiness with the breath is what causes you to let go of the attachments to sound and the attachments to your body and your attachments to thinking. Those are attachments. If there weren't attachments, you could let go of your body, sound, thoughts, whenever you want. You can't. It shows they're tied to your mind. There's a lock which keeps them so close to your mind that you cannot find the key to unlock and let them go. This is that key. Once the mind starts to get happy with the breath, you find that the body disappears. You find you can't hear any sounds. The thoughts simply can't come up because you're having too good a time to be disturbed by all this sound, this noise of your thinking mind. You're just watching that breath come in, go out. In fact, it gets so refined, as some have experienced, that that breath, you cannot know whether it's going in or going out. The in and outness of the breath is only one aspect of that experience. Just the same as my glasses case, the colour, the shape is only one aspect
of this glasses case. You've got other aspects, its texture, its feel, its weight. When we start with the breath, we just perceive that important aspect, if it's going in or going out. After a while, that particular part of the breath disappears from our consciousness. We don't know whether it's going in or going out. All we know is breath. The breath is happening. Now, I think I mentioned to you that some of you get concerned at this point. You think the breath has disappeared. The breath has not disappeared. It's just its appearance has changed. I get that similarly in the interviews. It's like a good friend of yours, who you've known as a Dhamma brother for many years, decides to take a novice ordination. They shave off their hair and their beard, their moustache, and they wear brown robes. When you first see them, you can't recognize them. Is that you? Wow, it is you. You look so different without your hair, without your clothes, without your studs and nose rings, what people wear these days. You look so different. At first you can't recognize them, but it's the same person. Just their appearance has changed. This is what happens with your breathing. When the breathing starts to get refined, it doesn't disappear. Its appearance changes. So if you're looking for your friend with his hair, with his suit, you won't find him. But if you're looking for that same friend with a bald head and a brown robe, you do see them. If you're looking for the real breath, not the one which goes in and out, but what's underneath that, then you see that at this stage. The mind is getting more refined, so it can take a more refined object. Instead of a breath moving, the experience you're watching is remaining still. What's happening here is that we're letting go of the body and we're letting go of the five senses. The Buddha did say that the breath is part of this body. It is included in the kaya sankhara, the bodily functions. Now we're letting go of the body. The breath is our doorway out of the body consciousness. Because what happens is that soon that very refined breath, which is extremely beautiful, will also disappear. What's happening now is the sense of physical touch has finally been turned off. Because we've been focusing on this breath, this very simple breath, we're not seeing anything. We're not hearing. We're not smelling, we're not tasting, but we're still touching. We experience the breath in that fifth of the six senses, physical touch. All the other four senses have shut down. We can't hear, see, smell or taste. We can't even most of that fifth sense is shut down. We can't feel our body, our hands. All we can feel is this breath, this moment of breath. And after a while, that shuts down too. The five senses have turned off. And with it, all experience of this thing we call our physical body. We've escaped from the five sense world. In the first jhana, you'll see its first description is vivicheva kamehi. Being aloof, being separated, not from the sensory pleasures, but the five sense world. Being separated from karma loka. Those of you who know your Buddhism know the three worlds, karma loka, rupa loka, and arupa loka. Karma loka is this world of the body, with its senses, with its trees, with its oceans, with its mountains, with its twin towers. That's the world of karma loka. It's the world of sex and movies, of soccer and relationships, of examinations and going to work. It's the world of birth and death of the body. Karma loka. But that is not the whole of this universe. The rest of the universe is called Rupa Loka and Arupa Loka, the three worlds. The Buddha was the knower of the world. That's what it means, not just knowing this universe, but knowing what's beyond this universe, the realm of the mind. I already mentioned, just as a small simile, just the mind is the biggest thing. This human world, this karma loka, is contained in the mind, not the other way around. That's why you'll never find a mind living in a brain, because the brain lives in the mind. Now, this world of the mind is far bigger, and in this, when you let go of karma loka, the realm of the body and the five senses, when that disappears, then what's left is rupa loka, the realm of jhanas, the realm of the mind. If you want to know what that mind is, if you want insights to see, to experience for yourself what mind actually is, this is the only way. You've got to experience the mind, first of all, to be able to investigate it. And this is the first time when you come face to face, as it were, with the mind. When the mind entirely, the chitta, can see the chitta. That, as you should know, is the experience of these beautiful nimittas. Only at that stage, when the whole body and the five senses have completely disappeared, only then can you really trust that what you're seeing is a real mind object. It is the reflection of your mind. What is actually happening, that sometimes beforehand those lights can come up, when you're still hearing and you're still feeling. What's happening then can be well explained by the following simile. I'm going to have to try and use both of my hands here. Usually the five senses are so dominant. We spend most of our time concerned with the five senses of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. But the sixth sense, the mind, is so overpowered. If I'm using these as the amplitude of the five senses, is represented by my right hand, which is so up here. The amplitude, the strength of the mind sense is way down. So a lot of time, the mind sense gets completely overwhelmed, and we know the world only through the five senses. When we do meditation, we are subduing the five senses. We are putting energy into the mind, and little by little the amplitude of the mind is increasing. As you see my left hand going up, my right hand going down. And the amplitude of the five senses, our concern for beautiful food, for sights, for sounds, is decreasing. The five senses in the body are getting less important. We're abandoning our attachment to the body little by little, especially in the retreat. And little by little, they came to roughly about the same amplitude. That is when nimitta can pop up. The mind, just for a few seconds, or even for less, becomes stronger than the five senses. At that point, we don't see, we don't hear, we don't feel. We see a light in the mind. But we still haven't really subdued the five senses enough yet. It only pops up a little bit, and then the five senses take over. The path of meditation, we really subdue those five senses until they're so low and the mind is so high, the five senses completely disappear and get overwhelmed by the mind. And that's when a nimitta comes up and stays. Six of the six senses, the five, have been so subdued, they turn off. And all you're left with is mind consciousness. In those six sense bases of Buddhism, five have disappeared, and you're left with the mind. There's some tremendous insights can come from that stage. First of all, you understand what the mind is. You don't understand what the mind is by reading some psychology or psychiatry or medical journals. You don't do this by listening to a monk or reading the suttas. You are face to face with the mind. That's how you can experience it and know what it truly is. To be known every wise person for themselves. And you can look and experiment with that mind. I've already mentioned one of the things which you can discover very quickly. When you're looking at that mind, a beautiful light, if it's not so beautiful, then neither are you. It means you've been heedless, it means you've been selfish, it means you haven't been keeping your precepts if that nimitta is dirty. If it's not bright and shiny, if it's not beautiful and pure, you can deceive yourself at every other stage of your practice. You can be in denial of the truth throughout your life. When you come face to face with your nimitta, there is no denial, no dishonesty possible, because it's bright, it's right in your face. You can't change this. And this is one of the reasons why that precepts, goodness, charity, compassion, all of these what we call paramitas, the spiritual qualities, it's at this point in particular you see just how vital they are to the path of the Eightfold Path. Those three factors of right speech, right action, right livelihood, what have they got to do, people say, with enlightenment? Surely you can be attached to your precepts. Surely you should just let go of precepts and just be free. Some people talk like that, you know, in the West especially. They just want to meditate, just be mindful and forget about everything else. To have crazy wisdom, thinking they're above precepts, because they're not attached, so they say. That's just complete ridiculous stupidity. The point is, if you aren't keeping your precepts, if you aren't doing good, if you aren't compassionate, if you aren't generous, if you aren't pure-hearted, then when that nimitta comes up, it won't be bright. And it will not be able to take you further where it is required if you're going to become enlightened. If at this point your nimitta is not all that good, check out how you live your lifestyle. Start keeping those five precepts, not just during retreats, but all your life. Don't lie. Keep that honesty. It's in your interest. It brightens up your nimitta. Don't take alcohol and drugs. Even a little bit of alcohol will sully and dirty that mind. A little bit of selfishness, a little bit of bad speech will cause enormous troubles. This is where you experience for yourself the sensitivity of the mind to goodness. And once you know that, if you are really someone who's committed to becoming enlightened, you have to be a good person, a kind person, a compassionate person, a generous person, a selfless person. Then what happens when that nimitta comes up and those five senses disappear? My goodness, that's a beautiful nimitta. Beautiful, powerful, shining, more brilliant than a sun. This is what happens sometimes when you see that nimitta. Sometimes it's so bright and brilliant you think that you're going to get blinded by its sheer intensity. But these aren't visions seen by the eye. This is just the way the mind interprets these things. This is a pure mental object. The mind is seeing this, the eye is not seeing anything at all. That's stopped, that's finished. It's because the realm of the mind is so strange, because we haven't got language for that mind, we always tend to interpret it. We get the best simile we can possibly find in our literally filing cabinet of memories. What is this experience most like? And what it's most like will be how you perceive it. What that experience is most like is a beautiful light. In those nimittas, it doesn't matter at all what color they are. The color is completely irrelevant. It can be blue, it can be pink, it can be orange, it can be white. It can even be black. That is not important. What's important is how beautifully black that is. I know one person who got a black limiter, but he said it was the most deep and beautiful, intense blackness. It was shimmering in its intensity. It was unworldly. You can't see blackness like that in this world. It was like velvet. It was like satin. It was just glowing black. That's hard to describe because these are things of the mind. Most people get colors. But if it's, say, a blue nimitta, which is one of the most common, it's not a blue which you can see in this world. It's not a blue which you see at the sky at night, nor anything which people can paint. It is much deeper and more intense, more rich, more brilliant than any blue you can see with your eyes. This is why it's weird, it's unearthly. It's not of this world, it's of the mind. But that's how it appears. When you come out and you say, what was that like? You say, it was blue, but not like a blue I see in the world. The most beautiful, intense, wonderful blue I've ever seen in my whole existence. That's the sort of thing a nimitta is. You're seeing your mind. The Buddha said that this mind, when it's free from defilements, is radiant. Pabhasarajita. That's what that phrase means in the Anguttara Nikaya, which, especially the false tradition of my tradition in Thailand, very often completely misinterpret. This is your experience of the radiant mind, just before and in the jhanas. The trouble is with those nimittas, they sometimes are so powerful, so amazing, so beautiful, so immense. They bring with it enormous joy and happiness. That gradual training leads to increasing happiness and joy. Now you're on the up and up with this happiness and joy business. Though it's so intense that sometimes you think you can't take that much bliss. You think you're going to explode. Because of that you have fear. The point is you're trying to control all of this. The fear is all about losing control. The point is, be aware of that. The whole point of this is to lose control, to lose a sense of self, to stop interfering, to let go. Sometimes people get that close and they blow their chance of going into the jhanas by trying to do something. They react to the power and intensity of the experience. There are two dangers which stop people getting into those jhanas. They get so far and then they have the two dangers, fear and excitement. The fear is the most common. This is too much for me. This is a bit going too far. I'm only a layman. I've got to go back to my husband after this. I don't want to be a monk yet. Sometimes it's so intense. Please have faith and confidence in the Buddha. Have confidence in your teachers. The Buddha said of those jhanas, Nabhayita bang, asewita bang, bahulikata bang, bahweita bang. In many places, say in the simile of the quail, Latuki Kopama Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya, he said, do not be afraid of those states. Make much of them, cultivate them, develop them, because they lead to Nibbana. You're getting into the amazing states, the mystical states. Enlightenment is not an easy thing. It's a profound thing, it's the most powerful thing in your, not just this life, in the whole series of the uncountable number of lives you've lived. You don't expect enlightenment just to come sort of sneaking in the door without any fanfare. Enlightenment comes with the biggest brass band, with power, with enormity. Sometimes we think we can't take it. You can.
Do not be afraid. Let go. What is fear anyway but the sense of self trying to control? The sense of self trying to own and think that what it owns is being taken away. I don't want to go. Leave me alone. Don't take this. That's fear. Selflessness. Letting go. Not owning. The important reflection, so when the limiters do come up, you can leave them alone. It's not yours. Nothing to do with you. You haven't got anything at all. Don't control. Then there'll be no fear. The other response is the excitement. At last, something is happening in my meditation. This is it. I'm close to nirvana. Oh, you've blown it again. Because meditation sometimes does get exciting. Wow, this is happening to me. Any wow, any excitement, any movement of the mind will stop the experience. At this time, please remember Ajahn Chah's tremendous simile of the still forest pool. Ajahn Chah was a great teacher. You may have heard that simile written in some of the books. It's not the full story as Ajahn Chah told it. The full story is all about what happens at just this entrance into the jhanas. It's a beautiful simile because the simile was Ajahn Chah, wandering monk, at the afternoon or evening, he would try to make sure when he's wandering in the jungles to find a lake or a river because monks need to wash after walking all day. They also need water for drinking. So he'd always try and find a lake or a river. Wash your body, maybe wash some sweaty robes, fill up your water jar, and then move away from the lake to camp under your mosquito net for the night. And there, having washed, having drunk, filled his water bottle, very often you just meditate with his eyes closed, go to deep meditation. But sometimes he'd keep his eyes open to watch the animals come out and play by the lake or the river at night. Because that's what the animals would do. They too, in the evening, would come out to drink by the water sources. But those animals were always terrified of humans because most of the humans were hunters. And they didn't know that the brown-robed monk was not hunting them for their flesh. So if he moved at all, if he made any noise, those animals would know and they would not come out. Even if they were thirsty, they would rather hide in the bush rather than risk their lives. So he would have to be absolutely still. When he was still, the animals would come out. And just like in these nature movies, he was so still they didn't know he was there. They would drink and play and frolic. It's wonderful to watch animals in nature when they don't know you're looking. But what was interesting was sometimes after the ordinary animals came out to play and to drink, he said that some strange animals came out. Animals he didn't know existed. The sort of animals that your teachers at school, your parents, have never seen themselves. Weird, strange, very rare animals would come out after all the other ones had drunk. They were so shy. If he moved in the slightest, they would know he was looking. Run away, would never come out again. These were the rare animals which very few people see. They were rare and wonderful, and he could only notice them when he was very, very still. Even just a little, wow, look at that, they would know and they'd run away. Any bit of fear because of their size or their strangeness, they would hear his heartbeat and go away. Any movement at all would be noticed and they would never come out again. Now you understand what the simile of the still forest pool is. It's all concerned with these nimittas and the jhana experience. When you're sitting still by your mind, watching your mind, that's when these amazing animals come out to play.
But if you move at all, if you try and control, if you shake your mind, if you have fear or excitement, those nimittas can see that, and they run away. They don't come out again. If you want to get to these stages of meditation, you've got to sit like a person watching nature. Be absolutely still, so the animals you're watching don't even know you're there. To be able to watch a nimitta, so the nimitta doesn't know you're there watching. No movement, no excitement, no fear. That's the degree of stillness you require at this stage. If you remember the still force pull by Ajahn Chah, you'll understand what's required. It's not impossible. You can do that. You experience states of stillness already. Just make it even more still. Don't move. When this happens, that nimitta gets brighter and more still. It boils up its energy. I've mentioned already just how when the energy doesn't go into doing anything, after time it all builds up in the knowing, in the mind, and that is what you're watching. And after a while it builds up to such an intensity that it ends up with one of two experiences, all the same but just seen from different angles, either you falling into the middle of that nimitta, or the nimitta expanding and containing you. Instead of you watching that nimitta out there, you come together. When you fall into one of those nimittas, it's called a jhana. When it's a real jhana, there's many things which you will notice afterwards, which is a sign that it was a jhana. Trouble is, when I talk like this, we get what's called spiritual materialism. People want these jhanas so much that they tend to bend and stretch the truth. This was a jhana, wasn't it, Ajahn Brahm? No. But I mean, it was like this, wasn't it? Like this. They want so much to be a jhana, they tend to bend the truth. Please know, if it is a jhana, there's no way you can be thinking. If you're thinking, it is not a jhana. If you can ask the question, is this a jhana? It can't be. If you can hear sounds, sorry, that's not a jhana either. If you can move, it's not a jhana. Jhanas are states of incredible stillness and enormous bliss. If you say you are blank, but not happy, that's not a jhana. If you say you are happy, but not blissful, that's not a jhana. These jhanas, incredible bliss. If you can go back to your room, lie down and go to sleep after a jhana, it's not a jhana. These energize you, give you more energy than you've probably ever had, like 10 or 12 cups of coffee. But you're still, but powerfully still. You're energized, incredibly happy. Usually when people get to these states in a meditation retreat, they come to see me just crying their eyes out. Oh, Ajahn Brahm, it's so nice. Oh, Ajahn Brahm, oh. It's like falling in love, only amplified 100s of times. I'm not falling in love with an experience, falling in love with the Dhamma. This rocks you, because you've never seen such a happiness before. It's called Uttari Manusa Dhamma, beyond normal human experience. But it's not inaccessible. This is experience. It is not just talking about Dhamma. This is getting to the heart of the matter. Something which really is going to knock you sideways. One of the first teaching which the Arahat Mahinda gave when he landed in Sri Lanka, It must have been an important teaching. It was number one when Buddhism went to the island of Sri Lanka. It was the Mahahatipadopama Sutta, the simile of the elephant's footprint. In that simile of the elephant's footprint, the Buddha taught about not just elephant's footprint, but how you know the footprints of a Buddha. He said the first footprint of the Buddha, the second, the third, the fourth footprint, are not to be found in Adam's Peak in Sri Lanka. The footprints of the Buddha are not to be found in, was it Prabhutabhat in Thailand? You know these places they say they got the footprint of the Buddha? That's not the footprint of the Buddha. They say the first footprint of the Buddha is first jhana. The second footprint is second jhana. The third is third jhana. The fourth is fourth jhana. So when you experience one of these jhanas, according to how the Buddha described it, you are standing where the Buddha stood. You are in the footprints of the Tathagata. That's why these are incredibly powerful and moving experiences. You're right to say that in that experience, you're knowing the mind of a Buddha. You're experiencing it. You know what it's like. That's why these things are really powerful and strong and moving. Within those experiences, you can't think. You can't move. Sometimes when people get into these states, they do miss their lunch, and their dinner, and their sleep. You all heard what I said to you the other night about that man who fluked to jhana. He said he'd never been able to do it again. When he got into that deep state, he got taken to hospital. He was okay. And they try to wake him out of his jhana. Even the electric shocks can't get you out. Let alone your wife saying, come on, dinner, dinner, dinner. Nothing can move you in those days. You don't know what's going on outside in the world of the five senses. But knowing has got no width. Knowing cannot move. To know in our ordinary sense, you have to compare. When I was young and still watching the television before I became a monk, on some of these quiz shows, they would leave you with a photograph on the television screen of an ordinary object, but taken from a strange angle. Like I say, example, a pencil, but taken end on, so it looked like a dot with a circle on the end. And the quiz, the test, was who could guess what that really is. It's so hard to see something and understand it if you don't move around. If I held something, if you didn't move around this way, that way, up and down, you would not be able to understand what this was. Much of knowledge and understanding needs perspectives and comparisons. In the jhanas, there is no movement. In the jhanas, you just... you're bliss, you are mindful, fully mindful, but you can't know in a way we normally know. That's why within the jhanas, you cannot know whether this is first, second, third, fourth jhana or what. That type of knowing is frozen. But what happens is when you come out of those states, when you emerge in due time, that's when, almost without fail, you would say, my goodness, what was that? Wow, that was something. When the mind can move again, you've just been through one of the most intense experiences, you are going to contemplate it. You're going to try and figure out what it was. You're going to look at it, and now you can move around. And that's where you find out what particular jhana it was. In the little booklet, which I've got there, I said some of the characteristics of the first, second, third and fourth jhanas. How each one is a little bit more refined than the last, the one before it. But each of those jhanas I described as like a series of concentric rooms. Imagine a building made in a circle. And you go in the door and you go into the first room. The next building is like another circular wall, which is actually you have to go inside the first building to go inside the second. Rooms inside rooms inside rooms. That's what the jhanas are like. You go in to the first jhana, and right in the middle of the first jhana you find the second jhana. Right in the middle of the second jhana gets the third jhana. Right in the middle of the third jhana lies the fourth jhana. And all those states which lie even beyond that, which I'm not going to talk about today, because they're also in that little booklet. You go in, and in, and in. Going in is letting go more and more and more. Each of those jhanas, when you come out afterwards, one of the ways you know one of the ways you know them is by the taste of their happiness. Every food has got a different taste. You get the taste of salt, the taste of spice, the taste of chili, the taste of sugar. Each of those jhanas has got a different taste. The higher you go in the jhanas, the more delicious they are. A different type of happiness, a different type of pleasure, is what really distinguishes those jhanas. The first jhana is the happiness born of letting go of the five senses, of thinking. That's the pleasure of that jhana. The second jhana is the pleasure of samadhi, of full samadhi, when there's no movement at all. The second jhana is known by its state of being diamond hard, frozen solid, where the mind doesn't move even a millimeter. If you want to know what stillness is, second jhana is where you reach real stillness. The third jhana is known for the absence of joy, a different type of happiness, more refined, more peaceful, more delicious. And the fourth jhana is known for its equanimity and the pleasure of that stillness of equanimity. What's happening here is you're becoming an expert on the different pleasures available. Whereas people who only know sex think that's the highest pleasure in the world, you find something more delicious. When you find that, your interest in sex disappears. When you find the first jhana, you're not interested in the pleasures of the world, because you know something much better. When you know the pleasure of second jhana, first jhana doesn't interest you, because the second jhana pleasure is, wow, that's even more delicious. The path of Buddha, of the Buddha, is of ever-increasing pleasure. Isn't that nice? Now you really know how to bliss out. Bliss upon bliss upon bliss. Finding happinesses you never realized existed. As you go through the jhanas, something happens to you. You realize that each one of these pleasures is because you've let go of something more. The pleasure, happiness, arises with letting go, abandoning, giving up. Just like that simile of the balloon, the more you chuck out of that basket, the higher you go. You're chucking out some things in that basket ordinary people cannot see, and you're going higher and higher and higher. Now you know why letting go leads to nirvana. You let go so much to get to those joys, now you decide to let go of the rest. And that is nirvana. Full abandoning, the ending of things. What happens is you understand that in those jhanas there's one important, not just the body and the five senses, they've been given up. You know when you enter a jhana just how heavy, how much of a burden this body is, and why the Buddha said these senses are burning. Even the most highest pleasure you've ever experienced in this world, the pleasure of falling in love, the pleasure of seeing your first baby
born out of your womb, or if you're a man seeing your child come out. Sometimes for women it's too painful. The inspirations of hearing amazing music played by the world's best cellist. All of those pleasures just fade into insignificant compared to the first jhana, let alone anymore. And you realize that even seeing a flower bloom, even seeing a sunrise, is pain, is suffering, once you know what's beyond that. That's a low happiness, so low that it's actually suffering. When the Buddha said these five senses are suffering, people can't understand that unless they know why. At this place, you know why the five khandhas are dukkha. It's not attachment to the khandhas, it's the khandhas themselves are dukkha. Some people can't say, how can you say that, Ajahn? I'm happy when I fall in love. How can you say that's dukkha? Compared to jhana, that is dukkha. It's like the simile I began this retreat with, of the worm and its pile of dung. If you don't know any different, the pile of dung is your food, it's delicious, it's yummy, and it's also your home. The five khandhas to a human being are like the pile of dung to the worm. They all think, this is wonderful, this is beautiful, this is lovely, if you don't know any different. But the Buddha was very skillful in sneaking that worm out of the pile of dung into jhana realms. And then you know, wow, actually this is right. This is what makes you let go of the body and the five senses. If anyone experiences jhana, could you really be concerned about sex, money, houses, movies, going here and going there? What a waste of time. A lot of people, if they experience a jhana as a layperson, just can't wait to become a monk or a nun. Their mind has left the world, now's the time for their body to leave the world. So be careful. If you get into a jhana, you might not have any choice. But more than that, in those jhanas, the other thing which is amazing when it disappears is this doer. The one who does your will. Who is in charge? Who decided to come here on this retreat? Who decided to move their glasses just now? Who's deciding to listen to this? Who is the controller behind you? Imagine a state where that controller has completely vanished, where all doing is impossible, where will just simply does not exist anymore, where there's no one in charge, but you're perfectly awake. That's like a jhana. When you see that this dua, this will, is impermanent, subject to complete cessation, it was there before, it's gone now, you realize the dua is not essential to your being. It is not always there. It cannot be you. The insight usually only happens in jhana, that you are not the one who does. Doing is not self. You are not in control of your life. You are not in control of your mind. You are not the one who does. It's fascinating because that really scares the pants off people. Do you think you're in control? That is the illusion of craving. There's no one in here. You had no choice but to come to this retreat. You had no choice but to laugh just now. You haven't got a choice that you thought you did. Can you get out of this room right now? No, you can't. You've got no choice in the matter. Throughout your whole life, you thought you were in charge.
No, you're not. Now that's scary. But you can really, you may sort of believe in that or trust or faith in me, but you don't really know that. When you get into jhana, you'll see that so clearly. That really shakes you. If you're not in charge, who is? No one is. It's just cause and effect. Rolling away. The path is Visuddhimagga. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. There are no yogis on this retreat. There's no Ajahn holding the microphone. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Nibbana is, but not the one who enters it. Isn't that fascinating? Isn't it beautiful? Now you understand that because you've seen yourself disappear. You've experienced disappearance of the self. At least the big part of it called the knower. The doer, sorry. The next thing which disappears is the knower. That which knows. Who hears this? Who hears your thoughts? Who sees your sights? Who listens to the sound? What knows? The difference between the first, second, third, fourth jhana, the arupa states, is the knower disappearing. That which knows fades away. Eventually, through this jhana practice, you get into the state which is known as cessation. The cessation of all that is felt and perceived. The knowing disappears. Hey, that's me disappearing. Yes, you weren't there to begin with. You're not there now. All has disappeared and stopped, with nothing left. Now that starts to really shake you. You understand that Nibbana is total cessation. Why not? Haven't you had enough of all this doing and knowing? This is what you find through the practice of jhanas. You can't think this out for yourself because it's too scary. But the pleasures of jhanas are so great, you think, who cares whether it's scary or not? I'm going for this. This is nice. I gave that simile, I think, to some of the monks in Perth. Sometimes you get that nimitta and it's scary to give up that last bit of self to enter a jhana, but wow, that looks good over there. That is bliss. You see it and think, should I? You know, you go for it. Pleasure is what makes you give up your sense of self. The end of suffering is the carrot which makes you let go. End of suffering is happiness. So that's the jhanas. These are amazing. These are weird. These are powerful. This is the stuff which gets you enlightened. Nati jhanang apanyasa. There's no jhana without wisdom. Panya nati ajayato. There's no wisdom without jhanas. If you haven't experienced those things, you don't know what you're talking about. But yamhi jhanang cha panya cha. In the one who's got wisdom and experience of jhana, they are that close to Nibbana. Do you still want to do this? Bit late now. Okay, that's a talk about Nibbana and jhanas close together. Any questions about that today? Yeah. How relate them to the jhanas, to achieve the jhanas, you are temporarily abandoning the first five fetters. Temporarily abandoning self-view, temporarily abandoning skeptical doubt, rites and rituals, temporarily abandoning karma, raga and vyapada. Karma, raga, the interest in the world of the body and the five senses. And vyapada is just the downside, the opposite side of that, the opposite side of the coin, ill will. Those are temporarily abandoned to get into a jhana.
not any jhana. And once you temporarily abandon them, you know how nice it is, the chances are that, well, I've tried it out, it looks, feels nice, let's do it properly, abandon them completely. Anyone who has abandoned those first five fetters, the anagami, has no problem and trouble at all about getting into a jhana. The non-returner, even, it's always said in the suttas, all of the lay people were non-returners in the suttas. The descriptions of them were people who could enter the four jhanas with ease, with no problem, at will, whatever they wanted. So if anyone says they're a non-returner, you ask them, have you got jhana, can you get into jhana? If they say no, they're not a non-returner. The non-returner, the barriers between them and jhana can be completely abandoned. The door is wide open. Whenever they want to, they can travel in and enjoy themselves. That's a non-returner. Yeah. Through meditation, yes, there's two ways of doing that. One is after jhanas, you reflect what's going on, that's where the insight arises. You look back upon those jhanas, your mind is empowered, you think out what that means, you say, I've given up so much, this is a bliss. You can see what else needs to be given up, you're high enough in the mountains, you see what else needs to be done, you give up the rest. Or you just go deeper into those jhanas. If you go into cessation, according to the text, when you come out afterwards, you're either a non-returner or fully enlightened. Only two possibilities after entering cessation. It's just too obvious. You can't have any other possibility. You've seen the mind end. You've seen there's no one in there. It's obvious. So even if you enter the state of cessation, the result of that, inevitably, the experience is just too strong, but to get the insight, which has destroyed at least the last five fetters, if not the whole ten. Yep. Can a person die while in jhana? It's very hard to die, but apparently it's possible. According to this one sutta which says, yeah, you can. But very, very unlikely. But don't worry if you die within a jhana. That's much better than dying when you're out of jhana. No, it's the... you may have heard me say that not when he passed away, when he was sick he would go in and out of jhanas. Even when he was in a coma, he was still practicing his jhanas. In a coma, yeah. Remember, in a coma means you can't speak out. You can't tell a person you're there. But you've still got your other faculties. You know, sometimes, like is that state I've read about in the magazines, when a person's being operated on. It happened quite a few times in the United States. They're doing an operation, they were knocked out with an anesthetic, and during the operation they woke up. They could feel everything, they could feel the knife cutting their body, but they weren't able to scream or move their eyes or do anything. They could feel, but they couldn't react. A very scary thing to do. It's so, so rare. And I think apparently because that's happened, they found some other way of knowing that this is happening. I think the heartbeat sort of changes or something. But they can't actually scream, even though can they feel all the pain. And it's traumatic, obviously. When they wake up out of the anesthetic afterwards, it's the most traumatic experience of their life. They've been in pain. They're not able to scream. That's right, yeah. That's right, yeah. The same way, similar, yeah. So in such cases, in many comas, you're perfectly alert and awake. You can't say you're alert and awake. Any other question? Yeah. Okay, the first question is emptiness the same as jhana? Like, emptiness is always relative.
empty of what? There's no such thing as emptiness unless you qualify it with what are you empty of. Okay, you're empty of a doer, you're empty of a knower. Yes, and that is empty. So if you look at the Buddha's, I think it's the Mahasunyata Sutta, the great discourse on emptiness. This is how the Buddha described emptiness, as a gradual emptying of the mind. He said, when a person goes off into the forest to become a monk, they're empty of all the stuff in the town, in the village, the elephants, the chariots, the bustle of people, and they can develop that perception of emptiness, that this retreat, we're empty of our work, of our family, of our business. That is an emptiness. It's in relation to what you're empty of. When you go into your meditation, you're empty of the coming and going. When you go into jhana, you're empty of the doer, empty of the five senses, empty of the body. Emptiness has to be empty of something. Yeah. If you're empty of everything, are you empty of knowing emptiness? If you are, how can you know emptiness? If there's something, there's always something there until cessation. In the cessation, you're empty of consciousness. So there's no one who knows there's emptiness. Everything stops. It's a relative term, correct? You can remain in the state of jhanas for how many eons was it? Something like a couple of thousand eons. That's, you know, an eon is from the Big Bang to the Big Crunch. So say something around about, what was it, 13,000 or 15,000 million years or something. So you got a few thousand of those. Quite a long time, eh? Sorry? Yeah? Doesn't matter because the universe comes and goes. Yeah. Can exist, yeah. But they won't mind. This is letting go of concern with the body, and that's what cremations and burials are all concerned with. That's why Buddhism, we don't worry about what we do with our body after death. You can take out all the organs of me if you want. You can sort of throw me in the compost pile if you want, because that's probably the best way of recycling. You can make trees and flowers and mangoes out of me. And when you eat those mangoes, now I touch on Brahma meeting. But don't be so concerned about this body of ours. When you die, just dispose of it in a sort of a reasonable way. And then just, you're not concerned about it. Because you aren't your body. Yeah. No, because people get into jhanas are brain dead. So if you see somebody sitting so still in their meditation, please don't remove their organs yet. If you see me sitting still, leave me alone. No, because it's true that that is a bit of a worry, moving your organs. But usually what happens is that there's some sort of trauma there. That you've had a sort of a cancer, you've had some road accident or something, and so that for most doctors, they know that, you know, it's not a meditation that you're brain dead. There's some reason, some medical reason why you're brain dead, and they know that your body's going to stop pretty soon. And it's pretty, pretty certain you've only got, you know, a few minutes to go before everything closes down. And that's usually when they take out the organs. So it's very, very, very unlikely they're going to take out your organs while you're in a jhana. Yeah, does that make sense to you? Is that what you're asking? That's right, yeah. That's right, because you can't use the old organs. Once the body dies, then the organs die as well. So it's a good thing to do. Just before you go, you make your last act of dana. Yeah. Yeah, that's really strange that you're asking us for the other recordings here, that there's a documentary of some monk whose tissues didn't decay, his organs didn't decay, just the same as a human being, but he died for many years. Is that a result of jhana? What's the result of it? It's so hard to tell that. That is beyond me. Could have been jhanas, could have been some other reasons. But I always remember reading in history that in the Catholic Church of the late Middle Ages, they would always know who a saint was if once they buried them, they dug them up a year or two later, they hadn't decomposed. That was supposed to be what happened to a saint. So they're always trying to test out who were the saints and who weren't the saints by digging them up every few years to see what was going on. Very well. That's pretty right. But then that stopped because there was this one, I think it was a count in Spain, and he was such a bad person. He had so many mistresses. He was so cruel. He was so, so selfish. He was debauched. He got drunk. He did terrible things. Because he was a count, they couldn't do anything with him. But before he died, he made his prophecy. He said, because he didn't believe in the church or anything. He was completely irreligious. And he said, all these saints who don't decompose, that's not a reason for being a saint. He said, look, I will not decompose when I die. And because he made that public, you know, they kept on digging him up, and he never decomposed. But they knew certainly he wasn't a saint. And after that time, they stopped digging up all these other corpses to find out who was a saint and who wasn't a saint. So they realized, sometimes you can not decompose and not be a saint. There are many reasons for not decomposing. You heard that story of going to the cemetery, where there was this famous composer was buried, Tchaikovsky. And they went there and they heard that Tchaikovsky's symphony being played backwards. So what's happening? So he's decomposing. Okay.